Good morning, Lynn Daily Item Readers. This is Mark White of the Talking Information Center. Reading today's Lynn Daily Item stories for today, Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. It's a cold morning out there with some snow flurries, do you believe it, on April 7th? But let's take a look at the front page stories. A new bill would allow ICE agents to be sued. On Tuesday, the Joint Committee on the Judiciary will hold a hearing to take up a new bill that would allow illegal immigrants and anyone who is arrested or detained to sue all federal officers, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers who took them into custody. The hearing, which is scheduled for Tuesday, today, is on Proposal S-2976, an act relative to violations of the United States Constitution under the color of law. Originally filed by Senator William Brownsberger in February, the proposed act will create liability for violations of the United States Constitution by any officer acting under color of law, whether state or federal. Brownsberger, who noted that excessive use of force by officers is a violation of civil rights in the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, stated this is the latest as part of a larger package of measures. The initiative was launched by Massachusetts State Senate President Karen Spilka in December of last year to counter actions by the federal government that would have a significant negative impact on Massachusetts and its residents. The Committee on Steering and Policy has since been tasked with analyzing how actions taken by the second Trump administration will impact the state and identifying policy solutions. The new bill would be the next iteration in response to ICE's presence amid statewide efforts to protect civilian rights. Back in February, Lynn Mayor Jared Nicholson issued an executive order limiting the use of city property and resources for federal civil immigration enforcement officers. City of Lynn employees or officials also cannot inquire about a person's immigration status during their routine duties. In March, over 100 Lynn community leaders, organizations, and labor unions gathered at the Commons to demand that even more actions be taken in Lynn, including having ICE out of the Lynn police station, as well as the Lynn district courts. They also called for a portion of the city budget to prioritize legal assistance to immigrants impacted by ICE or other agencies. Most recently, at a No Kings rally in Boston, Governor Maura Healey spoke to a crowd of 180,000 people and urged them to continue speaking out. "That's why in Massachusetts, I'm keeping ICE out of your schools, our daycare centers, our hospitals, our courthouses, and they're not going to be on state property," she said. "And don't even think about building a detention center here. Not going to happen in Massachusetts, ever." Courageous steps by Lynn. Congratulations. Also on the front page, Saugus Board bans kratom. The Board of Health held a public hearing Monday night regarding the banning of the sale and manufacturing of kratom, both natural and synthetic, in town. The ban passed in a 4-1 vote, with member Dr. Anthony Bacopoulos casting the lone no vote. Public Health Director John Fralick began the discussion by reading the statement of purpose for the ban. "Whereas kratom, a tree-like plant, is indigenous to Southeast Asia, produces a stimulant and sedative effect when orally ingested in tablet, capsule, or extract form. Kratom leaves can be chewed or dried, ingested as tea. Use of kratom can lead to psychotic symptoms and psychological or physiological dependence." The statement noted that there were several instances of overdoses and abuse documented across the United States, and that the vote would ban the manufacture, sale, and distribution of kratom in town. Resident Mike Fisher spoke during public comment, emphasizing that there was a major difference between synthetic and natural kratom, and that while he thinks there should be regulations, it shouldn't be an outright ban of all kratom products. "They are 100% unrelated and should be treated as such. Natural leaf kratom has mitragynine in it, which is the active ingredient. When that product is processed through chemical synthetics and synthesis, it turns into a totally different product, which is called 7-hydroxymetrogene-7-OH, Fisher explained. Fisher agreed that the synthetic product should not be easily obtained on convenience store shelves, but that the natural leaf should just have restrictions such as an age limit. The big misconception is that people group these two things together and they are not the same, he said, noting that major convenience stores like Circle K and 7-Eleven do a vigorous vetting process and all carry the natural leaf product. Fisher explained how many people feel safe drinking a cup of coffee, including himself, but that he would not feel comfortable taking a large dosage of caffeine pills, which can be dangerous. Yes, it should be regulated. It's not for children. It's meant for adult use only. There should be labels. There are ways that can successfully regulate without banning the natural leaf kratom product, he said. Joyce Redford, the director of the North Shore Cape Ann Tobacco Policy Program, stated that she supports the board's desire to completely restrict the product. We're not labs. We can't scrutinize the label on every product. A majority of the products that have been sold are, in fact, 7-OH, he said. Redford continued that the synthetic version is very dangerous and that even if stores were selling 100% natural kratom, they should not be at a convenience store but instead in a pharmacy or a natural food store that carries supplements. She also noted that some of the products labeled 100% natural had tested positive for having synthetic materials in them. Freilich said that while the product is being banned for manufacturing, sale, and distribution in town, the board is not banning the use of the product and that it can be purchased elsewhere. There have been a number of other towns and cities that are moving forward with this very similar language. Kratom has also been labeled as a novel intoxicating product with a potential for abuse. What we're trying to do as a board is what's in the best interest of Saugus, Freilich said. He also explained that if the FDA were to put its own rules and regulations on kratom, the vote of the board would be unenforceable. Board Chair Mary Tamagno was in agreement that there should be a distinction between natural and synthetic, but that, as of right now, the best option is to ban it completely. Bacopoulos, the sole no vote on the decision, felt that it was above the board's authority to ban a natural substance, especially if the state and the FDA were not moving on it. It just seems like one of those things we're not treating it as until proven guilty. We're saying you're guilty, prove your innocence, he said. Bacopoulos said he may agree with the board on the ban, but it felt too big brotherish to vote to ban a natural substance. Vice Chair Joseph Durant and member Joe Ciccoloni both stated their agreement with the ban. I can't say I've even heard of kratom, but there you go. Good background. Also on the front page, Swampscott will play it safe this summer. As the summer season approaches, Swampscott officials are expanding how the town approaches beach safety with plans to add lifeguard coverage, introduce new training requirements, and host a public event focused on water safety. Recreation Director Charlotte Dyer de Garcia is spending her first full summer in the position. She said the changes are aimed at strengthening preventative safety measures during the busiest months on the waterfront. One of the most noticeable shifts this summer will be expanded lifeguard coverage. While the town has historically staffed Iceman's Beach and Phillips Beach, the rec department is planning to add lifeguards at Fisherman's Beach as well, bringing coverage to another Swampscott's most heavily used shoreline area. The town hires all of its lifeguards through the Recreation Department with coverage expected to run daily from Memorial Day through Labor Day. Alongside that expansion, the department is also introducing a new training requirement for all lifeguards. All lifeguards hired this summer are going to have an added layer of waterfront training, Dyer de Garcia said. We're doing that this year for the first time. The additional training, which will be conducted in partnership with Wicked Safety Training and the Swampscott Police Department, will take place on the beach and focus on conditions specific to Swampscott's coastline. Derek DeGarcia said the change is intended as a preventative step towards safer beaches. Lifeguards will still be required to obtain standard certifications, including a lifeguard certification from the American Red Cross, YMCA, or the Boy Scouts, as well as a standard first aid and CPR AED certification. The town appears to be entering the season in a strong position when it comes to staffing. We got enough. I think we're looking pretty good. While communities across the country have struggled to fully staff their pools and beaches in recent years, Derek DeGarcia said Swampscott has not seen those same challenges, aside from a typical late summer drop-off when student workers return to school. In addition to changes on the staffing and training side, the Recreation Department is also planning a new public event aimed at connecting residents with the people and organizations involved in beach safety. Swampscott will host its first Water Safety Day on May 15th from 3 to 5 at the Fisherman's Beach with a rain location at the Swampscott Yacht Club. The event will coincide with National Water Safety Month. That's going to be an opportunity for residents to meet the lifeguards, meet with folks from the police department. That includes the harbor master, Derek DeGarcia said. The event will also include representatives from the yacht club, Friends of Swampscott Sailing, the Recreation Department, and more. Derek DeGarcia said the event is designed to give residents a better understanding of how safety is managed along the shoreline, while also providing an early season introduction to the lifeguards who will be on duty throughout the summer. Great, great steps that Swampscott is taking. Also on the front page, Nahant approves a new parking policy. The Nahant Housing Authority Board has approved a proposed policy aimed at addressing a long-standing shortage of available parking spaces at one of its properties. The proposals, introduced by Executive Director Kelly Collins, would establish a formal set of rules for parking at the authority's Chapter 667 housing development. Currently, the property has no official written policy governing parking use. The need for a structured policy stems from a significant imbalance between available parking and demand. According to Collins, the property includes just 19 total parking spaces, 14 standard and 5 handicap accessible, which serves a much larger group of residents. The issue has been under discussion for several months. The topic of creating a formal parking policy was first raised during the board's January meeting, with continued revisions through February and March. I started by asking other local housing authorities for their policies, and the board and I reviewed those samples. We put together what we thought to be the best information from those samples, in addition to how we currently handle the lack of parking. As discussions progressed, Collins described the process as iterative, with multiple revisions and outside input considered. Conversations with the external contacts such as Town Administrator Allison Nito and Selectman Robert Thibault helped inform the policy, though they understand our concerns but obviously can't make decisions, Collins shared, leaving further input to be reviewed through appropriate channels. The proposal focuses primarily on clarifying how limited parking resources are allocated. It outlines the spaces that are not assigned to specific units, except for handicap spaces tied to designated accessible units. It also establishes how initial parking assignments are made and what residents must do to retain them. I think it keeps everybody who has a designated parking spot now currently happy, Collins said. But I think it makes stipulations as to, if you have a spot, how you keep that spot. It's one thing to get a spot, but it's how you keep that spot going forward. Under the proposed rules, residents would need to meet specific criteria to maintain a parking space, including being the primary driver of the vehicle, maintaining occupancy requirements, and providing documentation such as registration and a valid driver's license. So long as you meet that criteria, you have your spot, Collins explained. The policy also addresses how additional or visitor parking is handled. Rather than designating a formal visitor space, the plan refers to an unpaved parking area located at the rear of the lot. This area would operate on a first-come, first-served basis and would be used for second vehicles or guest parking. In addition, the proposal includes a process for residents to indicate their parking needs, whether they currently have a space, do not need one, or would like to be considered for one in the future. The board also discussed plans to number each parking space and install signage to make assignments clearer for residents. While members acknowledged the possibility of future revisions, they emphasized the urgency of implementing a policy now. "It's coming to a point now that certain people are really aggravating the people who live here," Chairman David Wilson said. Ultimately, the board expressed support for moving forward with the current version, even if changes are made later. "I think that for the moment in time that we're in, this is the best we can do," Collins said. "Because there is no existing formal policy, the proposal would mark the first time the authority codifies how parking is allocated and managed at the site." Also on the front page, commentary by Aaron Hickey of the item staff. In defense of parentheses, it says, "Sometimes I like to think that within the Associated Press, there is a Starbucks enforcement division, and they have agents that wear sunglasses and carry stamps with red ink that say things like first offense, capitalization, and incorrect use of apostrophe. If this imaginary Associated Press Starbucks enforcement division had a courtroom, I'd be a regular. The AP Starbucks is basically like the journalist's Bible, meaning that it's really long, and nobody should tell my grandma that I haven't read it at all. It's full of rules pertaining to things like grammar, word choice, and whatever else could stop a writer from creative thought. For example, you'll notice in the sentence above, I've included an Oxford comma, not permitted in AP style. Also not permitted in AP style, spelling out numbers over 10, using a person's first name on second reference, abbreviating street, avenue, or boulevard without a numbered address, and having fun whatsoever. And against the spirit of AP style, I'm getting away from myself. This whole column comes from a recent conversation I had with two item reporters who do a lot of copy editing, and that conversation was about something that I do not care to imagine life without, the parentheses. According to the 57th edition of the AP style book, parentheses are jarring to the reader, which I personally think is a hilarious description of a punctuation mark, though I've had to argue inaccurate. I think brackets are way more jarring than parentheses, and those are actually allowed sparingly, she says, in parentheses. And I can understand not wanting to cause unnecessary shock to readers. That's why I didn't go with my original headline for this column, which in capital letters reads, "Help, I'm being wrongfully persecuted by the AP," but I think calling parentheses jarring is a little bit of an offense to the reader. "I mean, is this really all that shocking to you?" she asks, in parentheses. And like many rules, there are exceptions. You're allowed to use parentheses around logos and date lines, but pretty much other than that, they should be used sparingly, quote unquote. In some cases, I think it's a capital offense. For example, the style book is pretty firm that parentheses should never be used to insert acronyms. And for the most part, I'm okay with that one. I think if I say information technology in one paragraph and IT in the next, people hopefully understand what I'm getting at. But what, for example, if I want to talk about Nixon's 1972 committee for the re-election of the president, I'm not sure I even have the words to describe what I would be losing without the aptly abbreviated CREEP following that. The temptation to use parentheses is a clue that a sentence is becoming contorted, the style guide says. And I know what you're thinking. This guide is starting to sound a lot like those two old guys from the Muppets. And this is where, as a writer, really fundamentally disagree with AP style because I don't think a contorted census is really that bad of a thing. I actually think it's kind of the opposite. To me, oops, I'm sorry, I lost my space. I lost my space. To me, the value of the parentheses is mostly stylistic. They create a tone that I think more closely mirrors how people actually think and speak, not in single straightforward thoughts, but tangents and asides and insertions. In that way, I think they make writing feel more authentic, more human. When I use parentheses, it's a visual cue. Those cute little curve marks are a sign that what I'm saying here is my own voice. It's about establishing a connection between the writer and the journal. And we don't do that a lot in journalism. For some reasons I think are good, some reasons that I think are not. But we don't have time to get into all that, she says in parentheses. I should probably say, since I'd like to continue to work in journalism for years to come, that I understand why there are rules. I know that sometimes, when Animal wants another drum solo, the Muppets really need these two old guys to be the voice of reason. I just think that writing is a form of art. Telling a writer to avoid a punctuation is like telling a painter not to use blue. Sorry, Picasso. There's got to be room for creative thought. And that all comes down to trust. I trust the reader not to get jarred or confused by my parentheses. And I have to ask for the same trust, that if given the power to use them, I won't abuse it, as I already have 15 times in this column. So, the next time you catch me skirting the playbook, please, please don't tell the IAPSED because I can't afford to pay the fines and I'm too busy writing with parentheses to go to jail. So, a tongue-in-cheek article. Also on the front page, much more serious story, Lynn's DeMeo is indicted for murder. Lynn resident Anthony DeMeo, 18 years old, was indicted Thursday by a grand jury on the charges of murder and home invasion at the Essex County Superior Court. On March 12th, the Lynn Police Department received a call reporting a man walking around on Standish Road. He'd been holding a knife with a reddish-brown stain on it. The Bishop Fenwick Sr. told Lynn authorities they had killed a woman in Danvers. He was soon transported to Salem Hospital due to his erratic behavior. The Lynn police then conducted a search warrant of his home, finding clothing and cell phone evidence that led them to 17 Amherst Street, where they found 68-year-old Janet Swallow dead. There were no known ties between Swallow and DeMeo. At his original arraignment on March 13th, where he pleaded not guilty to murder and armed home invasion, it was revealed by the prosecutor that the teen had broken in through a window and stabbed Swallow while she was in bed. Swallow leaves behind her two sons, a stepson, a granddaughter, and many other beloved family and friends. She dedicated 30 years of her life as a nurse at the Leahy Medical Center in Burlington, where she worked in the critical care unit and intensive care unit. Swallow had a love for reading, being a member of several book clubs, the beach, and time spent with loved ones. It was decided that DeMeo would be sent to Bridgewater State Hospital due to the psychologists who stated that the evaluation, in my opinion, needs to take place in a hospital. Hold on, I'm sorry. Apologies for the interruption. So again, it was decided that DeMeo would be sent to Bridgewater State Hospital due to the psychologist, Dr. Joyce Parada, who stated that the evaluation, in my opinion, needs to take place in a hospital, but further assessment of his mental state, given the nature of the alleged index offenses, is a strict security of Bridgewater State Hospital. DeMeo remains in custody at the Bridgewater State Hospital and is scheduled to be back in Superior Court on May 11th at 9:30 a.m. Very, very sad story. And finally, on the front page, Peabody knows the recipe for kindness. As a way to remember and honor Jason Bernard, the 14-year-old Higgins Middle School student who died by suicide last May due to bullying, the Jason Legacy Foundation, alongside Peabody Promise and Peabody Public Schools, has begun its first annual Jay's Cookies, A Recipe for Kindness, an event that combines Jason's love of baking with a reminder for kids to choose kindness. Known for his curiosity, ambition, and big dreams, Jason had one hobby that stood above the rest, baking cookies. A cup of laughter, one caring smile, a sprinkle of hope, and a whole lot of love, these are the ingredients that we want our students to carry with them, said Celia Rosario, Jason's sister and the founder of Jason's Legacy Foundation. Jay's Cookies is about more than just a sweet treat. It's a reminder every student to choose kindness every single day. To honor his life, the Jason's Legacy Foundation was established to promote mental health awareness, bullying prevention, and community kindness. The foundation provides resources and programs like Jay's Cookies, designed to remind students to always choose kindness. By pairing Jason's favorite hobby with a powerful anti-bullying message, the foundation is committed to fostering a culture of belonging, ensuring that Jason's memory continues to inspire a world where every student feels seen, valued, and loved. The Cookie Gram Exchange is coordinated through the Peabody Veterans Memorial High School Culinary Arts Program and sponsored by the class of 2029, which would have been Jason's graduating class. The culinary students will be baking cookies with Jason's recipe next week to fulfill the orders that are put in from now until Friday, April 10th. Rosario said using his cookie recipe is a way to keep his memory alive and share happy moments with Peabody residents. The cookies are $1 each and proceeds will be split between the class of 2029 and Jason's Legacy Foundation. Rosario said all funds garnered for the foundation will go toward its scholarship fund. Each cookie comes with a kindness message, which are finalized by the class of 2029's student officers. The four messages people can choose from are, you are appreciated, be the reason someone smiles today, in a world where you can be anything, be kind, and then finally, kindness is free, pass it on. Additionally, D'Orsi's Bakery and Delicatessen donated 1,400 cookies to Higgins Middle School students, and each came with a Jay's Cookies, A Recipe for Kindness sticker. Rosario said this served as a reminder that something tragic happened here, but look at how we're turning something so sad into something positive. She added there will be an anti-bullying essay contest for sixth graders next month, and the receiver will receive a $100 Amazon gift card. Now, my friends, is a reading of the front page stories on the Lynn Item Daily Item for today, April 7th. This is Mark White of the Talking Information Center, and I will read for you again next Tuesday.